we're confronting a question which is very, very old, right? The Torah is very, very clear that poverty is one of the most stable features of human existence, as is inequality, and one of the most consistently not fully successful efforts is to rid the world of poverty. My parents are moving, I'll just share this, and they gave me a box of books that they no longer have space for, and one of them is a document from the 1970s about ending world hunger in the next 30 years. It was extremely poignant for me to flip through it last night and to figure out, well, am I going to keep this, or is this just another document that goes off into the past? So I want to share just two ways in which I think the problem that we face as individuals and as members of political organizations, Jewish political organizations, and then much, much larger American political organizations, is new. So one comes from the sociologist Max Weber, who describes our age as a bureaucratic age, right? We have distinct bureaucracies for doing all kinds of things, not just government bureaucracies, also, you know, scientific bureaucracies and medical bureaucracies and, you know, these large organizations with their own rules, their own cultures, that we kind of entrust with certain functions. And those are, in some sense, a response to the complexity of our world and to the scales of the problems and challenges we face. And they also create the complexity of the world and the scales and challenges we face. And I want to explicitly raise that in terms of tzedakah, because no matter how much if any of us gave as individuals, or even if all of us in this room got together to give all of our current wealth and future income to addressing the problems of inequality and hunger in America, we wouldn't get very far. And we should feel that. I think we all, you know, we often do feel that in painful ways and in frustrating ways and in disorienting ways. And that's a feature. It's a feature of our time. And the second way that this is expressed is by the philosopher John Stuart Mill, who's a rare figure. He was a philosopher, and then he became a member of Parliament. And he reflects, he offers two reflections in his autobiography towards the end of his life. One is how, of the necessity of bureaucracy, he says, you know, many people have well-intentioned efforts, well-intentioned initiatives, but at the end of the day, because they lack a sufficient understanding of the complexity of the market economy, of how human lives unfold, that we actually end up doing harm through our well-intentioned initiatives, and it actually might be better for us to hand the work off to experts. And the second is an extremely, it's one of the most honest and painful moments you'll find in an autobiography. It says, you know, in the course of my career in Parliament, we've affected almost all the major changes we wanted to in terms of advances for women's suffrage, in terms of changing how elections work and minimum wage reforms. He said, I'm not sure people in England are much happier than they were or much better off. It's an amazing moment to really reflect back on a political career. And so I wanted to share those. Just by way of thinking about what it looks like for an individual to take stock of where she or he is and where we are in thinking about the stubborn, perhaps intractable problem of inequality and not simply giving up. So we're going to look today at three models of how communal responsibility grows out of or even grows out of conflict with individual responsibility for caring for people around you. And this is going to be one of those really simple thesis, antithesis, synthesis models. It's like A, not A, resolution, okay? The first one is going to be the community is just an outgrowth of us. It's a bigger version of our responsibilities. The second one is going to be the community picks up exactly where we leave off. It's actually in conflict with us. And the third is going to be trying to articulate some division of labor. So I want us to start off, we're going to read these fundamental verses that will come up in a few different ways here. So we're on the first page that has a lot of Hebrew in your packets. And I'm going to ask for a volunteer to read. You can pick your language. Great, tell us your name.
Bracha.
Bracha, take it away.
Ki yevacha evyon me'echad achecha ve'achad she'erecha ve'artzacha asher...
That's Hashem, as printed, so this won't be shameless.
Noten la, lo tametz et levavcha, v'lo tikpotz et yadcha, me'achecha ha'evion. Ki patoch tiptach et yadcha lo, v'havat tavitenu, daimasro asher yachser lo. הישמר לך, פן יהיה דבר עם לבבך בליעל למור, קרבה שנת הסבה,
השבה, the seventh year,
שנת השמיתה, וראה עיניך באחיך האביון, ולא תיתן לו, וקרא עליך אל השם, והיה בך חן.
Great, I'm just going to interrupt you for one second there. The premise here, which is a totally fascinating premise of Sefer Devarim at least, is that there's actually not anything like what we would call tzedakah or charity, right? There's no giving of money to someone who needs it without the expectation that it'll be repaid, right? There are interest-free loans, and the expectation of the person giving them it is eventually they'll be repaid, probably, you know, with the new agricultural season. And so the danger that poses here is in a context when all loans are forgiven in the seventh year, that Shemitah year, that sabbatical institution itself being for the benefit of the indebted, it can also lead to a lockup of the credit markets, right? People will say, well, I'm not going to lend because I know, you know, I'll lend you $10,000, but in 5 days the loan is going to be forgiven. Like, that's not a self-interested proposition. And so people will say, well, the Shemitah year is coming. I won't give. I'll just start again when the loans will have more time to be paid off. That's the context here, this anxiety that's being spoken against, being railed against here. Great. Keep going.
Natan titen lo, v'lo yira levavcha v'titcha lo, ki biglal hadavar hazeh, yivarechecha Hashem Elokecha b'chol ma'asecha u'b'chol mishloach yadecha. Ki lo yachdal evyon mikeret ha'aretz, al kein anochi mitzavcha lemor, patoach tiptach et yadcha le'achecha le'aniyecha u'le'evyoncha ba'aretz.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, so now I have a simple question. Who is this speaking to? Is this speaking to individuals or to a community? And how do you know?
It's in the singular.
It's in the singular, great. All of the things, right? You is the singular here. This is not y'all in the plural. It's your land, so singular. Great. And what kind of enforcement mechanism? Oh, yes.
But I think it's a bit more complicated because it's right. Speaking in first person, but it seems, at least the way I'm wanting to read this very clear, that it's addressed to a first person collective of Ki Yihya Becha Avion Mecha Dachacha, which is singling out a specific person from among a community.
Great, great. So it's a collection of individuals, perhaps. Great. So now I want to introduce one more term from Max Weber, who has, like, in some ways, a real reductionist, and he has what for our purposes now is a helpful definition of government, which is the most powerful violent organization in any area. Right? It's like, at the end of the day, who runs the show, who can, you know, impose violence. And the reason I want to introduce that here is I want to ask precisely, what's your name?
David.
What David is raising is the idea that maybe there's a collection of individuals here, and what I want to suggest is there's not a government enforcing this. Right, that's, I think, kind of emerges very clearly that there's no enforcement mechanism because, first of all, we see that the unit that's deciding this is an individual, right? A sovereign individual who, because of their own calculations, wait, this won't turn out well for me, I won't get repaid, can on their own then decide not to give, right? And the response to that, to your deciding not to give, is God saying, give. Like it's a religious move, it's a rhetorical move, it's an ethical move, but it's not saying, if you say I won't give, like, don't worry, like, someone will come and make you give. Right? That seems to be absent from this. Someone can come and make you give. You don't need to refer to people's better angels to make them do the right thing. And the other side of that is that there's not only a kind of a plea to, there's a promise that things will go well if you do, right? The most concrete incentive, there are incentives offered to the people here who are moneyed, which is that somehow in the longer term this will turn out well for you. Yeah.
I'm just asking that there's no punishment if you don't.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, there's no punishment if you don't, and there's a promise of good if you do, which is, right, this is, you know, I can, as a parent of a toddler, right, it's like in those situations that you really don't get to, you're like, you'll get the lollipop if you do it, right? That's like the moments when you can't force them are the moments you have to appeal to self-interest. Yeah.
It does say v'haya lecha chet.
Yes, it does. Which it, right, so you, and what does that mean to you?
It's like, it's, you get punished for sins. I mean, it's not specified what the punishment is, but.
Yeah, so it seems like this chet is not, is punishable only on a, or I'll say only on a theological level, not on a judicial level.
Maybe punishment to be determined later.
Maybe punishment to be determined later. Look out. Yes.
That was my question.
That was your question.
I was going to ask you what that meant.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think a place where you can see this happen really, really clearly in the Torah is if you look back through Parshat Mishpatim, there's a set of the casuistic cases, right? If then, if an ox gores, here's how much you pay. If someone steals, here's how much they pay back. And then the Torah actually switches to a set of statements which do not have punishments attached to them or do not have legally actionable punishments. Like, if you keep the garment of a poor of someone overnight and they don't have anything to sleep in, they will cry out to me and I will, you know, help them. And what you see there, that context is very clear, and I think it's implicit here, is that on some level that's a weaker level of enforcement or a less tangible level of enforcement than the comparison of, like, if you do X, you know, you'll have to pay this much. It's a different register. Yes, Braha.
Could the U be hinting towards a united collective?
It could be, but there would be an easier way to say that, right? And we can talk about, you know, there's language of the king in Sefer Devarim, and there's language of you, a plural you, which would, I think, more directly suggest that. Yes?
The idea that this is a community is somewhat bothering me, because if this is a community, then clearly the poor is not part of the community.
Yes.
It talks about the poor as someone from the outside.
Yes, that is 100% correct.
So if you just talk to a specific rich person, it's obvious. But if you talk about Klal Yisrael, then they are under the group.
Yes, right. This is speaking to people with property and land, just like in the paragraph about Shabbat, right? Laman, in order that you and your slaves may rest. Well, that's not addressed to slaves. yes, so this is addressed to a subset of people, right? Tzedakah here only applies to some people. And I want to just make one note on this last verse, which is the paradoxical one here. For there will never cease to be needy ones in your land, which is why I command you to open your hand. You could have imagined something more motivating. It's like, if you just open your hand, you'll solve the problem forever. And that's why I'm telling you to do it, right? It's precisely an assertion of, on some level, the futility of this project as one of social reformation, but it's necessity for the concrete person in front of you. It's a changing of the frame. And I want to offer just one more application of this, I think, which is the picture here is not when you give, you're purchasing a lower poverty rate in your society, right? It's rather, it's like, I am commanding you to open your hand and give as an act of passing on the gift of prosperity that you've received. Right, this is the classic language of the gift economy, which is the whole structure of this perek of Devarim, right? That you, when you, your things are not ultimately yours and not yours by rights, and the most important way that you can express that is by freely giving them away, just like you freely received them from God. Yeah, David.
I think there's also something more linguistically that very subtle of ki yechiebecha evyon ki lo yechdam. If I remember earlier, you've got that it's a progression of there won't be, if there will, there very definitely will
yes.
be.
Right, that's exactly right. There's a context almost that looks the opposite and the contrast until you read them as a narrative progression. That's exactly right. So I want us to keep going now, and what I want you to do, I want you to break into Chavruta and spend maybe, let's say, 6 minutes with the person next to you and read these next three sources together. So one is from the Tosefta, which is about, the Tosefta raises the question of, you know, at what point do you start paying taxes in the city you move to, right? In our version, right, how long do you have to be somewhere before you change your driver's license, right, or show up for jury duty? So that's the question the Tosefta asks. And then the Rambam, in chapter 9 of Gifts to the Poor, which is the next three, one, paragraphs 1, 2, and 3 there on page 2, really like lays this, how these out, how these different institutions of tzedakah give it work in a pretty direct and clear way. And what I want to suggest at this point is these are the kinds of institutions that a person who cares about fulfilling what Devarim, Sefer Devarim has said, doing it well, doing it effectively, doing it at scale, these are probably the kinds of things you would set up. Right, that there's a certain kind of harmony between the two. So take 6 minutes. If you don't know the person next to you, all the better. Introduce yourself. Pick your language, and we'll read through it. We'll come back together, and then we'll move on to a more conflictual model. I'd love to hear from maybe two different Chavruta, what you noticed, anything that was particularly interesting, noteworthy, important. Yes, and tell us your name.
So what Philip here pointed out, that in Rambam it seems to imply that they need to have some kind of structure, communal organization.
Exactly. So the Rambam gives a kind of a full-blown bureaucracy for how this is to be done. And there are different roles, there are different timetables, a whole different thing. It's short-term, long-term, right? It's very well-developed. Great. Yes?
Raisin, I noticed nowadays it's the opposite. Every shul has a voluntary BIM, but not an assessment.
Very interesting, right? And to the extent they have assessments, it's not going to the poor.
Right.
It's going to the building fund. Yeah, Joe.
I'm also struck that it's a wealth assessment, not an income. It's not an income tax.
Yes.
Right? It's based on your total assets, presumably.
Yeah, so this would be a fascinating thing to understand, the shift from wealth to income, is how we think about people's means. And I think there's a lot of push now after Piccinni's book, Capital, a shift maybe back to thinking about wealth is really what divides us. The thing I remember so clearly learning this Rambam more than a decade ago is the first line of the last paragraph, Me olam lo ra'inu v'lo shamanu b'kal Yisrael she'en lahen kupa shel tzedakah. No one has ever heard of a Jewish community that does not have, not just that doesn't give tzedakah, but that does not devote human resources and structure and thought to the giving of tzedakah. Such a thing does not exist, he says. It's an amazing statement to be able to make. Just an incredible thing to think about. This is constitutive of what it means, not just to be a Jewish individual, but a Jewish community. And I think you can feel, in a sense, the harmony between what we read in Sefer Devarim, that this is, God is saying in Devarim, this is a fundamental aspect of what it means to be in covenant with me, to be a person who opens one's hand and gives. And the Rambam is saying, actually, descriptively, it is true that it is a fundamental piece of what it means to be an organized Jewish community, to figure out ways to effectively give. Right? It's just that simple. Right? There's nothing more foundational than that. Yes?
I don't think it's just that simple, because I think that the real difference between the time of the Rambam and our time is that all of this is voluntary now. So, yeah, we do have the Kupa, UJA, Fed, and any other,
yes,
number of groups, let's say. But it's not a tax system. Nobody
good.
Makes us give.
Good, good. So I want to ask you now to read the... Oh, yes.
But that's unique to America. I mean, in Europe before the Second World War, they did tax you.
Right.
The Jewish communities actually had an enforcement mechanism, and in Israel today you can argue that they have something similar. America is unique. It is, in some ways, voluntary.
Right. Okay, and what's your name?
Fran.
Okay, great. So Fran, I'm going to ask you to read now the next section of the Rambam, where this the harmony will shatter. Okay, so take it away. Right, so this is now, if everything we had before is, oh yeah, individuals give, communities give, great. Now we're going to see a pretty different picture. Either one is great.
When a person does not want to give charity or desires to give less than what is appropriate for him, the court should compel him and give him lashes.
Wow.
For rebellious conduct of whom he gives the amount it was estimated that he should give, he takes possession of his property when he is present and expropriates the amount that is appropriate for him to give. We expropriate property for the sake of charity even on Fridays. This is worse than the IRS.
Right, this is like the IRS times a lot. So let's go through this. So the stance here, the unit under investigation, I'll walk us through and then I'll take questions, is not the community anymore. It's how the individual, a recalcitrant, stingy, miserly, greedy, you can add on your adjectives, individual, looks from the eyes of the community. So what happens? The court compels him, lashes him until he gives the amount he should give, until he pays his taxes. And now, okay, I thought that was the mechanism by which he gave. Oh, no, wait, there's a different mechanism also. We take possession of his property when he is present and expropriate the amount that is appropriate. So I just want to be clear. That's like they come in, they're like, oh, we could sell off that TV and that laptop and that set of kitchen knives and that sofa. Oh, that'll pay your bill. Great. And then they back the truck up and the men come in and take those things away and load them up. And then the kicker here, I think you can all feel this, we expropriate property for the sake of charity even on Friday. Right? It's Arve Shabbatot, right? It's like, you can't be like, oh, wait, I was going to give, but, you know, like, the rice isn't cooking and it's taking me longer. Can you come back on Sunday? The answer is no, we're not coming back on Sunday. It's like, your house is turned upside down. You have guests coming over. Well, I guess you're going to have to borrow chairs for them to sit on because we're taking those. Right? That's the drama of this scene. And it's one of those moments where that extra legal detail, I think, emphasizes so much. It's like, oh, you thought you needed those things? These are people coming over? They're actually people who need those things. And we're going to be giving these things to those people now. Yeah, Blair.
Well, I was just wanting to clarify all of this, what they're owed is based on what is appropriate for them and the assessment made upon them.
Yes.
So is that subjective, or is there an organizing body that's assessing?
Good question. We don't know, and we'll get some guesses. In the next few sources, but it's clear that it's not just their own sense of what's appropriate to give, right? Because they would say, I've given enough, and the people coming in taking the things are saying, actually, you haven't. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Avital.
I also am wondering about how the assessment is based on how much it's appropriate for you to give, not on what they need. Like, if you were lucky enough to live in a city where you had no poor people, if it were appropriate for you to give some amount, then it seems like they would still come into your house or your habit.
Right, so I think there is some, my imagination of how this works is the total amount of need divided in some kind of proportion.
Okay, not like by a percentage of how much you have or something.
I don't think it's just, we'll take the money and then figure out what to do with it. Yeah, David.
Just going for a bit of a more technical thing.
Yes.
I'm noting in the Hebrew that it mentions Malkot Mardut. Is that implying that the obligation for tzedakah here is Derabanan or Doraita?
Yes, good question. That is exactly what we're going to. So Malkot Mardut, right, is what's imposed on someone for violating the law. It's a punishment for a kind of rebellious act, and this becomes a major question in the interpretation of this Rambam, right? And I raised a different question on this before. Why do you both have to lash them until they give and just come and take their stuff? Either it's a belt and suspenders approach. Either one should be sufficient. So I want us to see, I want to be clear about how fundamental this conflict is, because oftentimes it'll be the case when you're learning Torah that there are two different ways of thinking about something. And those two different regimes are in conflict, right? You know, Shabbat as a primary, you know, engine of rest and equality versus Shabbat as an expression of, like, sanctity and covenant, right? Those are different views, and they at some points come into conflict. This is something very different. This is a mechanism that exists for the sake of conflict. Right? The communal mechanism is not like, oh, there's one view that tzedakah is primarily individual and one view that's primarily communal, and like every once in a while those bump into each other. The communal institution exists to be in conflict with individuals here. Does that make sense? If individuals gave enough, you wouldn't need this. Right? This is to the extent that the need outstrips what is going to be offered by people who are, you know, trusting God's promises or give for others. Only to that extent, only to the extent that there is conflict, is there a raison d'etre for this halakha here in the Rambam.
Let's look at it, because half of the job of the gabbai tzedakah is also to allocate it for
Kohanim. Good.
So, and also to make the whole thing work.
Right.
So, maybe I want to give, but I'm busy, and this guy shows every Monday night and at the time that I'm at home, so it makes it possible.
Right.
Otherwise, I wouldn't.
Right, and there is a soft power of creating social norms, but you'll see where I'm getting this very stark formulation of this. Yeah, Toby.
I'm not exactly sure how it fits in with this, but we were doing some family research, we're looking at a family member who lived in Savannah, Georgia, and was evidently not very successful in business, and was buried in a free Jewish cemetery. But then there's a paragraph in there that says the cost of the burial will be paid by the representative of the Jewish community who has been selected for that year or whatever to collect monies from the
Amazing.
Jewish community to support the free Jewish cemetery. So the city was saying, we're going to bury him, but somebody has to pay for it. But they didn't go to an individual, they went to the Jewish community. And then
Very
the mechanism was that the Jewish community had to elect someone every year who was responsible for somehow...
Who got the bill.
Yeah.
Wow, so...
community monies to support the...
Wow. So when we get to Maimonides, a different section from the Rambam on page 2, I'm going to ask you to read it really in this vein of how there is some connection, it's really interesting you brought up, between some kind of genealogical research and the giving of tzedakah. The Rambam will give a different version of it. So I want us to look now at this Gemara in Bava Batra, which is the heart and soul of this discussion, and I'm going to read us through it here. And what I want you to look at really carefully is the metaphors that are used for the Gaba'i Tzedakah. What are they compared to, or to whom are they compared? Okay. So Tanu Rabbanan, Kupa Shel Tzedakah, Nigbet Bishnaim, Umitchaleket Bishlosha. Right, so it's collected by two people working together and distributed by three people working together. Nigbet Bishnaim, She'eno Sim Srarut Al Hatzibur Pachot Mishnaim. It's an amazing statement. No one is put in a position of authority over the community alone. It's a really interesting model of leadership. You could even do a whole thing just on that line, right? The default is if people's money is coming into your pocket, someone else is there as a check, right? All checks are double signed. That's the default. Okay? Umid chaleket bishlosha kedine mamonot. And it's given out, distributed by a group of three people, like the judges in a case that involve where money is at stake. Right, so we have this interesting, this is the first hint of it, we'll see it more clearly, introduction of a picture that the Gaba'i Tzedakah are like judges. Okay, then there's a little ellipses here. My Suraruta, well, what is this sovereignty? What is this authority that the Gaba'i Tzedakah have such that they need a check on them in the form of another person? Da Amar Rav Nachman Amar Rabba Bar Avua, Lefi Shememashkenim Al Tzedakah Filu Be'arvei Shabbatot. Right? It's because this line, this is where the Rambam got it from, that they have the power to seize your property, even on Friday afternoon. Right? That, they have that kind of power, the Weberian power. Right? When they come to take your TV away, the police will not come and say it's theft. Right? They are the ones who decide what the right time to take away, to seize property is. And then the Gemara says, Ini? Is that the case? Can they really do that? V'hakativ, ufakati al kol achatzav. God says to Israel, I will exact retribution from all those who oppress you. And look at this. This is like a little anti-tax moment right here. Ve'amar Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta mishmei d'Rav ve'afilu al gaba'i tzedakah. Right? I.e., when the gaba'i tzedakah come and seize people's things, they're oppressors. Just like anyone else who seizes things. Like, we, you know, everyone has their justifications, has their reasons, how this is the greater social norm, the means justify the ends. But at the end of the day, they're stealing stuff from you. Right, that's the force of this. And the Gemara is going to reject that, but the idea surfaces there for a moment. La Akasha, no, don't worry. Hada Amid, Hada La Amid. Right, if you are of means, Hada Amid, you're wealthy, then they come and take your stuff, and they're right to do so. And if you aren't of means, they could actually be wrong in a given situation. Right, if they come and expropriate your things and you don't actually have enough, they're taking more than they should from you, then they are classified as oppressors. And now here's the story that's going to become the kernel of so much going forward. Ki hada Rava achfei l'Rav Natan bar Ami b'shakel mine arba me'azuzei litzedakah. Rava actually compelled, I lost my spot there, Rav Natan bar Ami to pay 400 zuz of tzedakah, which is an incredible quantity of money. It's basically enough to sustain a family for 2 years. $50,000, $70,000. And also, the person who wasn't giving it is a rabbi. Right? I hope that's not lost on you. But we have a story here where such a thing happened. Exactly. 200 goats. A whole flock of goats. Okay. And now the last line, which I apologize, there's a terrible copy-paste error here, and the English didn't make it in for this last line, so I'll just translate for you. This is a quote from Sefer Daniel. Hamaskilim yazhiru kezohar harakia. Right, the enlightened ones will shine like with the brightness of the firmament. Zed dayan shedan din emet lamito. That part of the verse refers to a judge who gets the law right, who brings justice. The second half of the verse now umatzdike harabim kocholchavim laolam vaed, and those who make the community righteous will shine forever and ever like the stars. Elu gaba'i tzedakah. Those are the gaba'i tzedakah. Right, they make the community more righteous. And so there's a lot of material here, but what I want to suggest is there's a new picture of the Gaba'i Tzedakah, and this will become the dominant thing in the third section, as the judge. Right? That's the parallel at the beginning of the sugya, at the end of the sugya. Right? There's a conflict. I remember I asked one of my good friends who's a lawyer, how do you deal with just being in conflict all day? And he said, like, the conflict is already there. The courtroom just organizes it. And that's the picture here, right? The gabbai tzedakah, there's conflict between people who have money and don't. And the gabbai tzedakah are organizing it, just like the judge would. There's an implicit lawsuit being brought against you every Friday afternoon. And it's being judged, right? That's their function. And we'll see what it looks like to do that well here. So we're going to see a Mishnah here from Kiddushin, which may seem kind of irrelevant, but the Rambam is going to make it really relevant. Okay, so the question here is about yeches, about checking someone's lineage. Are they fit for a certain kind of marriage? In a picture of who were their ancestors? And the question is, how far back do you go? At what point do you feel like, oh, that's good enough evidence that they're of acceptable stock? So here we go. Ein bokin lo min hamizbeach velamala. So if we know that if someone's ancestor was a Kohen who offered sacrifices, that's enough. You don't need to say, well, maybe they were wrong to let him do that. No, it's like you've hit bedrock there. Vilomin haduchan ulamala. And also, if they were a Levi who sang from the duchan and used that as kind of stage, you also don't need to go further back. That's good enough evidence. They were presumably vetted for the job properly at the time. Vilomin hasanhedrin ulamala. Similarly, if they were on the high court, that's good enough evidence. Okay. And also, v'hol shuch zaku avotav mishotrei harabim, if someone had a position of authority in the community, v'gabayei tzedakah, or if they were a gabayei tzedakah, m'si'in l'kuhuna v'ein tzarich livdok acharei, and they can marry into priestly families and you don't need to check further back. Now watch what the Rambam does with gabayei tzedakah here in his commentary on this Mishnah, because it's not, you'll see, parallel precisely. It's not that just like with the Sanhedrin or with the priests who are officiating in the temple, we assume that they were sufficiently vetted, that we can't do any better vetting. It's something else that's revealed when someone becomes a gabbai tzedakah that means you can trust their lineage. So Toby, I want you to ask to read this passage from Maimonides here.
We do not investigate.
From the collectors of charity in that, just the bottom paragraph. So this is a comment on that line of the Mishnah.
Collectors of charity. They are constantly battling with people and forcing them to give according to our principle. We seize possessions for tzedakah even on Friday. So, if they had any disqualification, others would have insulted them with it.
And it would have been.
It would have become well known.
Great. So this. What did you say?
She's been so vetted by the press.
Exactly. Right. If there were any dirt, it would have been dug up already. Right, the pictures, this person is like, I mean, it's actually an amazing moment to think just structurally here. The gabbai tzedakah, so there's two things. First of all, the way you can tell they're doing their job is people are mad at them. Now I'm going to be like a little bit more political here. So it may be the case that the way you can tell that like the government is doing its job with the right kinds of taxation is some people who are losing more in that regime are really mad about it. Right? Yes.
The idea is that there's such an obvious opportunity for people to have enmity towards them that we would obviously know if they were doing something wrong. Like we expect people to be angry at them, and so obviously if they do something immoral, it would be...
We expect people to be angry at them, and therefore the person who's mad, right, that they just had their vacation home in the Hamptons taken away as their friends were like arriving on the jitney, told they have to go back to Manhattan.
I can say that today.
Those people are going to be so mad at the person who did it that they're going to dig up all the dirt they can on them. So if they had anything bad in their family in the past, it will become known. Right? Or in other ways, the person, because what you see here is an attempt on the person who's just had their money expropriated, their wealth expropriated, to attack the communal institution by attacking the individual who represents it and their family, basically. Right? You actually see that moment come up again. So the Rambam, I just want to be clear, it gives you such a picture of like, this is not like, the good old, this is not like Anatevka, right? This is like these people are out there, they're getting insulted, like their families are getting threatening calls, like their kids are getting called into the principal's office, whatever it is, you can imagine, right? All the like those levers of pressure that are exerted on people who are really trying to do so, like push against the power structures of society are being applied to these people. and that has like a halachic nafka mina. It's like you can rely enough on the opposition research that's been deployed against these people so that your kids can marry their kids. It's like there's nothing more reliable than that, than like the anger of people and having their like, you know, stuff taken away. It's an amazing, amazing nafka mina here. Yeah, David.
What's catching my attention from a bit of a different perspective back in the Gemara is how much this is causing me to think of things in Masechet Shkalim. When you have
yes.
money that's imposed as a tax to pay for the keep the Beit HaMikdash up, I'm remembering some of the same amount of how many people you need to collect it
yes.
is
yes.
the same. And the one detail that I assume would come up in terms of Gabayetz.ka but isn't mentioned is that the Mishnah and Shkalim gets into the we regulate the clothes they wear in terms of pockets.
Yes.
Lest anyone have any suspicions
yes.
that are these two sources like pulling from
no, yes, exactly. And those come up they're parallel to each other in all those ways, exactly. Right. The idea is that they shouldn't wear anything with pockets, so there's nothing to hide anywhere. It's an amazing thing about things like the Panama Papers and everything, right? So I want us to keep going now. Now we're gonna get to, for those of you who've been like, well, this is all interesting, but I want something that's like a difficult Talmud shear. You're in luck. Okay. So what I want to try to do is take these kind of these intuitions we've had about like, you know, a harmonious communal relationship with individuals versus a conflictual one, and we're going to actually see how this is formulated in a very, very precise and I hope helpful way in the Gemara. So there's going to be a lot of different texts floating around and kind of being remixed and reinterpreted. When things are not clear, I'm going to rely on you to say, wait, what just happened with the Gemara from Kolin? And we'll recap it as many times as we want to. I'm going to try to walk us through in the most orderly way that I can here. Okay. And as always, we first have to introduce a whole other context to understand what we've been talking about. Okay. So here we are. We're in Aseret HaDibrot, Parsha Yitro. Kabed et avicha ve'et imecha, lema'an yarichun yamecha al ha'adama asher Adonai Elohecha noten lach. Right, honor your mother and your father in order that, you know, your time be on this land go well and be long. And for people who haven't read it, Rav Shai wrote a very beautiful Devar Torah on this last year, that the implication here and the connection with Shabbat actually seems to be elderly parents who are not financially independent anymore, or financially dependent on their children. There's actually maybe some, like, fairly integral connection between this mitzvah and tzedakah. Okay. Why are we talking about that? Here's step one. So here's the Gemara from Chulin, which we're going to refer to as Chulin from now on. So Aituhu lahahu gavra delo hava mokir avua v'ime kaftuhu. So they brought a man in front of Rav Nachman who was mistreating his parents, and he was bound. He was going to be punished, right? He's in chain. They brought him in handcuffs before Rav Nachman. And here's what Rav Nachman says, shavkuhu, let him go. D'tanya, because we have a tradition that says, Mitzvot aseh shematan schara betzida ein beidin shelamata muzharin aleha. Right? Courts are not instructed to enforce any positive commandment accompanied by a reward. Okay, so just to be clear, what's happening is there's what feels like a very technical rule, but I'm going to suggest it's not technical, that whenever the Torah says, do X in order that I, God, will give you Y, that whenever the verse appears in that form, with the reward next to it, human courts don't have jurisdiction. And so since the fourth commandment says, right, the fifth commandment, it says, honor your mother and father, in order that you may endure on the land that the Lord your God is engaging you, because of that promise, there's no enforcement anymore. It's like it would have been better for this mother and father had God stopped after kabed et avicha ve'et imecha. So that can feel like very, very technical. I want to try to motivate it a little bit. Yeah.
But what caught my attention with that is, don't we have an implicit, if not explicit, reward for tzedakah in Dvarim 15?
Yes, we do. I'm so glad you said. So let's go back to page one. Yes.
And do we see tzedakah? Is it an assay?
Oh, that's Tosfo. Good.
Good.
Great. So what David is pointing at is, which verse number is it? Point us out to it.
15:10,
right? Give him readily and have no regrets when you do so, for in return the Lord your God will bless you in all your efforts and in all your undertakings. That seems like a very parallel statement. So that is exactly, you saw the train wreck coming from you know, hours beforehand. Okay, so statement number one. Here's why I want to
say. Different from
You could try to do that. This gets invoked in enough different places that it seems to be fairly independent of the specific linking terms. So here's how I want to justify this, which is when, I say it this way, when, and this is what inspired my comments earlier about the lack of an enforcement mechanism, when the Torah resorts to rhetoric, to imploring, to beseeching, to promising rewards, implicit is the idea that that's the strongest inducement you have, right? If the Torah meant to say, do this, you know, honor your mother and father, if you don't, you'll be whipped, well, the Torah says that many places, right? There's actually an implicit removal of human judicial authority, or an absence of human and judicial authority when divine reward is the only sanction for doing something. And I suggest it's actually...
Like that's just the perpetrator of the crime.
Yes.
It's not very just for the parents.
Right, so we might say to God, right, well, God, why, you know, we need you to step in here. We need you to empower human beings to step in here. Exactly. There's something troubling about a kind of divine absence. But what I'm trying to suggest is, as a read of the Torah, I think it's a good one, right? There seem to be different genres of mitzvot, some of which say, you know, if you don't keep Shabbat, you will be stoned to death. And some of which say, if you honor and mother your father, things will go well for you many generations from now. And I think you're sort of saying, well, I guess I probably won't be stoned to death, because if the Torah meant that, it knew how to say it, right? And there actually seems to be different categories of mitzvot already in the Torah. In this sense, yeah, Joe.
Thinking it may have something to do with the specificity of action, right? Like, honor your father and mother,
right.
Like, love your neighbor as yourself are kinds of mitzvot aseh that it's not clear what that could mean in practice, whereas Shabbat, even in the biblical,
right.
Even without the rabbinic Shabbat, still has specific
right.
laws.
Right, and interestingly, it's the thing nowadays in terms of Shabbat, like, because all Jews agree what keeping and violating Shabbat looks like now, right? Like, it's part of me, that's part of what's going on. Yeah, Rachel.
I think there's something, too, in that, you know, what you do in public and what you do in private, and honoring your parents is something important to do in public, because
right.
you want a society that honors their elders and takes care of each other, but... maybe your parents don't deserve that kind of respect. So you want a society where that is the case, but in your individual instance, that's not something you want.
Right, there's a real imposition here, and I think there's also a reticence on the part of, you know, government-style bureaucracies to intervene in families. Like, you know, foster care is not the most successful government program in America, and it's very hard to, like, fix families from the outside in the way that it might be imagined or hoped for here. Okay, so this is, you now all see the problem here, and now I just wanted to see it, see these two kind of come together, family and tzedakah. And so they're going to come up here in this interesting sugya, which has its own fascinating moment that says that the obligation for a parent, i.e. in this case, presumably the father who's has the income, to provide for his children, to financially support his children, ends when they turn 6 years old. And then the Gemara deals with a number of cases of fathers who are, just like happens nowadays, are not supporting their children financially. So here's one example. Ki hava ata lekame de Rava. So such a man, a deadbeat dad, came before Rava. Amar le, nechalach demitzane banecha mitzdaka. Oh, you seem to be happy with the fact that your children are like charity cases. How do you feel about that? And that's the extent of Rava's judicial involvement in the sugya. Now the Gemara is going to say that's not paradigmatic. Velo amran ela de la amid. Rava would only say that in a case of a father who actually didn't have means to support his children. Aval amid, but if he did, kafinan le al korche. You force him to give, right? Garnish his wages, I guess would be how we do that nowadays. I.e., right, even though it's midin tzedakah that a father has an obligation to support his older children, he can't rely on others' tzedakah. It's still his tzedakah, right? It takes the tzedakah and turns it back into an immediate relationship. Ki hada rava kafye la rav natan bar ami va'afik mine arba me'azuze li tzedakah. Just like we saw earlier in Bava Batra, Rava, in fact, did this and expropriated money from someone who hadn't given. And this raises the interesting possibility that Rava did this specifically to Rav Natan Bar Ami for Rav Natan Bar Ami's children. We don't know for sure, but it's a possibility. So we see here this moment of tzedakah again becoming so central. Now, Tosfot is going to ask exactly David's question on this sugya. So let's look at Tosfot here.
Can I throw a it sounds like you're seeing one bright line division between the two economic classes, the people who get stakha and the people who are abiyus. And I have assumed that there was a big middle zone.
Yes.
Who owe some stakha and can't claim it, but maybe are not so rich that...
Yes.
And just go and take CDs.
Yes, and I think the people, this Amid category, includes people who should give, right? It's Amid, La Amid seems to be the poor, people who can't give any more than they are.
Because the picture of the person who's actually impoverished, the guy who actually has no money to support his kid and has no food, presumably he's getting money from Stucca too. You want to be like, dude, why aren't you supporting your kid? He can't support
his
kid.
It's like getting blood
so
from a turnip, right?
The picture was a guy who actually can't afford to support other people's children, but he can still put, spare a crust for his own child.
Exactly. That seems right. Amid, is not, Amid is not just the wealthy. Right, it's also seems like a middle class category that has.
So then, why is he saying that to the person who's not on it?
Well, the person not on it, I think.
Has the money.
Right, he doesn't have the money. Right, Rav is not doing anything. He's not doing it in a not nice way to this man. Right, I mean, I think what Elisha was pointing out. If you read the man in the story is poor, like what with no, he doesn't have means to support himself. What's he supposed to do? And on one level, the bottom line of what Rav is saying seems to be like, there's nothing he can do except I don't know. Maybe it's like a little, conservative, tough love, help him get a job, right? Like, it's not clear, but he's not trying to, take anything from this man. There's Right, so we don't know exactly where the man falls or how these categories fall out, which is, Blair's question from the beginning. How do these assessments work? Okay, so Tosfot's going to try to figure this out now. So let's walk through their three answers, their question and their three answers. So remember, so Rava is the our expropriator-in-chief, and so, how is Rava expropriating money from people based on tzedakah? But isn't it said, tzedakah, as David pointed out, has a reward there, as it says, in order that God may bless you. Like we saw, okay, so that's the problem, right? Tzedakah fits in the genre of the Torah, so that it should be classified like the Gemara, the story in Chulin about Kibud Avim, but we see that it's treated as a legally actionable case that comes before the court like other mitzvot. How can that be? Okay, so three possibilities. One, Yesh lomar de'achvie bidvarim. One, he compelled him with words. He didn't really compel him. He just shamed him, yelled at him, organized protests outside of his house, whatever it was, put up a Facebook page against him. Soft pressure. Okay, so that's kind of like taking the tzedakah case and really assimilating it to the kibud avim case, right? Tzedakah, there wasn't really any compulsion here. Tzedakah also falls under this aegis that there's no enforcement. Inami, number two, kitzvu b'nehem b'nei ha'ir l'teikach b'kach l'chodesh hilkach achvei k'dam rinan b'feret kama d'bava batra. Actually, in a different part of the sugya we studied, the rishain b'nei ha'ir l'hasiyah al kitzatan. Okay, possibility number two. Oh, actually, in the background of this story with Rav Natan Bar Ami and Rava, there was an agreement that the people of the town had made. They set a certain tax rate, and because there's a kind of social contract of they can make binding agreements with one another. That had happened. No one told us about it, but it had happened. And Rav Natan Bar Ami had failed to meet his obligation. So it's not because it was tzedakah; it was because it was a binding contract that he had violated. Right. So again, tzedakah, if you haven't explicitly agreed to pay a certain amount, does not compel you to pay. But if you've agreed to pay it, then you can be compelled to pay it. Right. So again, in this, what'd you say? Like a pledge to federation. And it's very interesting. Our pledge is legally actionable. That's like a whole interesting legal thing. It has accounting implications for not-for-profits. But yes, that would be exactly the idea. So again here, tzedakah loses out. It becomes, tzedakah is not enforceable. Contracts are enforceable. And some contracts happen to be about tzedakah. Okay. Possibility number three. The ode. To be tzedakah ika tarte lave. Lo ta'ametz the lo tikpots. Right? The tzedakah is not just a positive commandment, and this is in the direction Razi was suggesting. Right? There's actually a lot of, language and injunctions here, and some of them are negative commandments, which courts can impel. So that's like a linguistic statement that might have some more depth to it. I mean, you were asking about Laman versus Biglal, but it's in terms of the specific formulation of the mitzvah. Yeah, Elliot.
Why does Tosfot want to force the mitzvah tzedakah onto the passage about lending? But these are still talking about loans that are given back, while it's clear that the setup in the Talmud time is,
Yes, great question. That is, I think, like an almost unquestionable assumption. We raise the curtain on it in a certain way, but it's really bedrock. Okay, so I want to look at one way. We're actually going to do these out of order now. I want to do the Yerushalmi first, and then we're going to have to introduce one more sugya, and then we can see the hero of the story, the Ritva. Okay, so here's the Yerushalmi. This is on the bottom of five, if you just look over to the right from the Tosfot. K'tiv. It says, Mozne Tzedek, Avne Tzedek. Okay, there are two verses that talk about having just balances, fair weights and scales. And one of them is in Vayikra here. Mikan amru chachmim, from here, the sages said, Kol mitzvah shematan schar betzida ein beit din muzharin alah. Why did they say that? Because of the parallel in Sefer Devarim, which is quoted here in the passage. Even shleima v'tzedek yihelecha, aifa shleima v'tzedek yihelecha, lema'an yarichu yamecha al ha'adama asher Adonai lehecha noten lach. Right? Very clearly, having fair weights is it falls in this genre of mitzvot that have a divine reward and therefore no human punishment attached to them. So yihelecha, in that verse, is read to mean manelecha agronimos alkach. Right? Which means appoint a market overseer, an enforcer of these rules. Yihelecha, it will be for you. It's like you've got to make sure that the weights are fair. And so therefore you have to appoint someone. That's how the verse is read. And then the Yerushalmi says, V'temar hachin? And you say this? So just, what's going on? The Yerushalmi is very elliptical, but here's what it's clearly saying. We have this verse, which we have the commandment of fair weights and measures, and that's which clearly has a divine reward and therefore no human punishment. But it also is read to mean you have to have someone to enforce this. Well, how can those two fit together? Someone to enforce this means there's human enforcement of it. So here's an answer. Amar Rebbe Bon Barchia Kini Matnitin. This is how to read that statement of the court is not doesn't enforce mitzvot that have a divine reward next to them. Kol mitzvah shematan schar betzida ein beit din netnashin aleha. Any reward, any mitzvah that has its divine reward next to it, the court is not punished if they fail to enforce it. So in this sense, right, it's not tzedakah that's lost out, it's that the rule itself has been gutted. It's kind of the court has discretion, I guess you would say, about whether to enforce it, but if they decide to, they can. All it means is that the court is not compelled to compel people to follow this. The court has the option. Okay. That's going to be in the background for a second. We have to introduce one more source before we get to the Ritva. Yeah, sorry.
Wouldn't it be that the person who's granted to appoint a supervisor would be kind of the people who are buying at the market? Wouldn't that be kind of something that would be in everyone's interest and not necessarily wouldn't even get to the court?
Right, so the reason that I think the Yerushalmi feels like it can't say that is because of this reading of Yihelecha as Manelecha Gronimos, right? Which means there's a bureaucracy, there's a delegation, there's a specialization of the enforcement, not a general thing. There's like a person whose responsibility is this, who can impose sanctions, right? A whole kind of legal style apparatus.
It sounds to me like it could be an internal thing, though, not necessarily coming from a court. Like theoretically, it could come from inside this market.
Right, it could come from inside the market, but the idea that the Torah says, right, manelecha agronimos, means that it's not just if you want to, right? It's some kind of external imposition. Okay, we need one more context. Again, it'll seem like it comes out of nowhere, but it's going to be very important for the Ritva. Okay, so here we're in Sefer Devarim, and the context is making nedarim, making oaths or vows. And the key thing, I just want to look at the third verse here, verse 24. This is now, we're now at the top of page 5. Motzas fatecha tishmor. Right? Fulfill what has crossed your lips. Vasita kasher nadarta ladonai lohecha, nedava sher debarta beficha. Right? How do they translate it here? Perform what you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God, having made the promise with your own mouth. That's right. If you say it, you've got to do it. This is kind of like solution number two in Tosfot, right? You can make it. There are lots of things that you're not obligated to do, but once you say you're going to do them, now you're obligated to do them. Okay? So we're going to look at a very short sugya on that, and then we're going to put everything together. Okay, so Tanu Rabbanan. Now we're in Rosh Hashanah in the middle of page 5. Motzas fatecha, zo mitzvat aseh. Right, so this seems to say, and how you get exactly from these words to these legal implications I don't want us to dwell on, but let's say you can. What comes out of your mouth, so now there's a mitzvat aseh, there's a positive commandment to do what you said you would. Tishmor, zo mitzvat lo ta'aseh. So now there's also a negative commandment not to not do what you said you'd do, right? It's kind of sandwiched in that way. Ve'asita az hara levetin shiye asucha. This is a warning to the court to make you do it, which will become very important for us. Kasher nadarta is a neder. Okay, that's one type of vow. La'shem alokecha elu chataot v'ashemot olotu shlamim, right? The Lord your God, these are the sacrifices because they're going to God. Nidava kamashma'o, it's a different type of vow with slightly lower level of obligation. Asher dibartu elu kodshe bedek habayit. This is just like David, who's not there right now, was saying, right? Things that are dedicated to the upkeep of the temple. And then b'ficha, the last one, zot tzedakah, right? Vows of tzedakah. Okay. Now, the connection here is not that clear, but what we're going to see here is the Ritva, Rabbeinu Yom Tov and Avraham, one of the great, great Rishonim, try to make sense of these sugyot. And he's really, most of this passage is quoting his teacher, the Ra'ah of Aaron HaKohen. So the context, I just wanted to be really clear, is you cannot really have both the Gemara and Chulin that says mitzvot that express a divine reward are not enforced, and the Gemara in Ketubot that says Rava enforced tzedakah, right? That's you're trying to make peace between those. And the Ritva is going to introduce a new way of doing it, which is where we'll conclude and reflect on for just a few minutes. Okay, Vatema. So some of this will be familiar because he's like Tosfot. Heach, it's bewildering. Heach mamashkinin ala tzedakah. How can we expropriate for tzedakah, especially on Friday afternoons, I would say. Deha mitzvata seshema tanzchara b'tzida, right? Positive commandment accompanied by divine reward. Ve'enu yuzharin beitin aleha. So, right, that's the problem. Okay, here's answer number one, which I was going to reject. V'teirutz b'yirshalmi. So we saw this Yerushalmi. Ein beitin ne'nashin aleha. Right, the court doesn't get punished. Kelomar. Muzharin hen lachuf, right? They are, the court is instructed to enforce this mitzvah. Aval im ha'elimu enehem, v'lo kfa'u ena nashin, k'moshin nashin al shar mitzvot ase, im lo kfa'u. Right, so if they decide not to enforce this one, if they decide to look the other way, they, the court, are not punished for that, there's a good word I'm looking for here, discretion is really the legal word, right? And this is in some ways what a lot of the immigration debate in America turns on right now is the discretion of executive authorities. So that's one answer, right, of the Yerushalmi. V'omer Rabbeinu de la Gemara Dilan Leit Lehi Svara. My teacher said that the Talmud Bavli, the one that we follow, doesn't think this way. It's like in the Yerushalmi, but that's like less canonical than being in the Bavli. It's not that we gut the rule of positive commandments accompanied by reward aren't enforced. We keep that rule in general. Ella kol mitzvat aseh shematanzcha katuv b'tzida ein beit din muzharin klal. Right? The court does not enforce these at all when they have rewards. K'da'amrinan b'masechet chulin hahu gavra d'lo mokar avua v'ime. Amar le Rav Nachman kafte amar le d'lo bai l'michveh d'kol mitzvat aseh shematanzcha b'tzida ein muzharin ala v'im kein heach mashkin yatzdaka. He says, right, the Gemara and Chulin, when Rav Nachman said, let that man go, it's just like hard and fast evidence. Rav Nachman seems to have felt like he didn't have the authority to impose anything. Rav Nachman wasn't like, well, I have discretion in this case, but he seems like an okay guy, so I'm going to, you know, use this loophole I have to not enforce anything. Rav Nachman seemed to say, like, we have to let him go. Like, this one's between him and God. It's not for us to decide. That's the first. So, right, the first move that the Ritva has made is that the idea, this action, the story of Rav Nachman's is strong enough to kind of push aside the Yerushalmi's rejection of this rule. Okay. V'teiretz Rabbeinu. So how do we deal this? Deshani hacha. It's different here, specifically in the case of tzedakah. The gali be'kra dichti ve'asita. Right? Remember we had that ve'asita in the line about vows or oaths. Azhara leveitin shiye asucha. Right? That the court enforces things. That's like a statement that there's a certain important set of cases that the court enforces. And there's something that'll be confusing about this, which I we're going to all note together. So if it doesn't quite line up, you're right. Mishum dahacha, v'lo gamrinan min ala ama. We don't extrapolate this from this to all other cases where there's a positive commandment. Why mishum dahacha, lav mishum mitzvah deramia ale, bilachud kaifinan. It's not because of the mitzvah of this person to give tzedakah that they're not fulfilling. Ella mipnei shuchievatz nechasav ligavah olanim, because he has obligated, he's placed a lien against his property to give them to God or to the poor, depending on the nature of his vow. Uchshem shekofino tolifra mashech hayav lehedyot. And just like we enforce debts that you owe someone, not because you have a specific mitzvah to pay them, just because the court makes, you know, moves property to where it belongs, so too, once you've made a vow, that property isn't really yours anymore. It's not like you have a specific mitzvah to give it, but you have to give it, and that's what they're there to make happen. Shelo yehei koach hedyot chamur mehekdesh, right? So if you collect liens for interpersonal debts, all the more so when someone's made a vow. Okay? Now, what's unsatisfying about this at this stage? Exactly. The Gol Gemara and Rosh Hashanah is about vows. The court only enforces vows. Like, how did you get this to get us to the context of enforcing tzedakah? It's like so limited. So now the Rosh is going to address that in his comment on Ketubah. So look with me on the last page here, page 7. Aval hecha da'amid kaifinan le, right? This is the statement, right? The father who is of means is compelled by threat of violence to support his children. Perush midin tzedakah, right? This is an act of tzedakah. Ve'af al gav dahave mitzvata seshematan schra betzida, even though tzedakah is a positive commandment accompanied by a divine reward, ve'kaimalan dekol mitzvata seshematan schra betzida ein beit din muzharin alaha, right? And we have the principle that kind of by default it should not be enforceable by a court. Hatem hu bishar mitzvot. That only applies, that rule that the courts don't enforce, it only applies to every other positive commandment, but not tzedakah. It's amazing. He's like, he's not willing to give up on either the rule or tzedakah. Kigon, kibura ve'em uchiyot tzedakah, those other ones. Okay. Aval inyan tzedakah kaifinan. We use force when it comes to tzedakah. We use violence when it comes to tzedakah. Mipnei machsoram shel aniyim. Because of the needs of the poor. It's like fundamentally different. Uchidaktav rachmana ve'asita azhara leveitin shi'asucha, right? And now we have this statement, right? The court can enforce it from ve'asita, which is about nedarim, which is about vows. Ve'af agav dahahu gabe noder kativ. Even though that's said in the context of a person who makes a vow, that the court can enforce the vow, gale rachmana bitztaka shotzi b'fiv. The Torah was explicit about a vow of tzedakah that it can be enforced. Ve'hu hadin l'chol tzedakah. But that same statement applies even not in the context of vows. Now, whether this is convincing or not is a different question, but he's addressed the problem at least. He says, like, the fact that the Torah said this about vows for tzedakah, that a court can enforce it, is actually true of all tzedakah, even if you haven't committed yourself. You're already committed to it, and we'll see someone say that in a minute. Mishum machsoram shel aniyim. Because what he's doing here, which is so compelling, right, is tzedakah, he's trying to move the center of gravity. It's not whether you feel like you have an obligation to give. There are people with needs. They're the kind of the center from whose perspective this case is evaluated. And you may be a roadblock. You may not be fulfilling your mitzvah to give, but that's not going to stop us from making the right outcome happen. Okay? And now we're going to see this formulated really clearly by the Ateret Paz, Rabbi Pinchas Zvichi, who's still alive, one of Rav Avadya's great students. And he's commenting here on this ritva. V'hainu dechavanato lomar, right? So the ritva means to be saying, da kfiya eina biglal chiyuv hamitzvah, right? And I want to be a little technical here. The enforcement that the court enacts against this person with means, is not because of him as a gavra. It's not because he has an obligation which he hasn't fulfilled, which they're kind of helping him fulfill, forcing him to fulfill. Ela biglal hachov shiyesh lo le'adam zeh, l'shalem la'aniyim. It's because he has a debt to the poor. Shemamono mishoabad lehem litzedakah. There is a lien against his property for tzedakah. It's not his. It's in the wrong place as long as it's in his domain. Vehevi kekfiyat depriat bal chov l'shalem et chovo. And tzedakah is no different than paying someone a debt you have to them. And so the picture here is it is not you, your giving is kind of almost a secondary mechanism. What happens is by nature of possessing wealth, some of it already doesn't belong to you. Even if you never said anything, even if you never agreed to anything, and the enforcement of that debt, which you never, you know, you didn't sign any papers, like, it doesn't matter. It's like, your role in this is somehow secondary. It's like, that wealth, most of it's yours, and some of it's not. And it's in order to make the money be in the right place that the court intervenes. Now, there's a separate plane about, are people doing the right things? That's what the personal mitzvah of tzedakah is here. But the court is, at this point, acting as judges. Right? The question is not, did you do the mitzvah right? Did you not do the mitzvah right? This is not a religious question, in any means. They're acting as a civil authority to make sure money is where it should be by rights. Yes, I think it's a religious question. It's also a civil question. Yes.
Hence the connection between tzedakah and tzedek.
Say more about that.
Well, we tend to think of charity as this voluntary, supererogatory kind of thing versus tzedek, which is justice. And here what we're having is the turning of something that seems like a kindness on your part into an obligation, into a debt.
Beautiful.
Where justice prevails.
Right, and we might say you as an individual are responsible for tzedakah and the court is responsible for tzedek. Right, you're responsible for a certain action, a certain giving, a certain open-handedness, and not being a hard-hearted. But the larger, like, picture of how, like, what, where money is and where it should be, like, you don't have that perspective, you don't have that responsibility, but someone else does. Yeah, Talia.
So then I wonder if, like, there's a numeric right distinction, right? 10%, I think, is the going rate for what doesn't belong to you.
Right.
And then if going back to, I guess it was what Rambam originally said about Tamfui versus the Kapa, I wonder if Kapa is that 10%, and the Tamfui is like above that.
Great, right. What do these numbers come out like? Right. And are they, is it 10%, is it a flat tax, or are we going to tax in a more sophisticated way? Yeah, Racha.
So there's something about someone who is not willing to give tzedakah that places them at a distance from people who need the tzedakah. Word tzedakah starts with tzad, which means side. It's like
very nice.
You have a responsibility to take someone's side, to be in that corner.
That's very nice. So I'm happy to stay and take more comments. It's 11:30. I want to just close with one thought here. The implication here is, people talk about, you know, if taxes are too high and that has all these bad implications. The implication here is if taxes for tzedakah are too low, we all might have stolen property. The stakes are no lower than that. And our governments, our coercive authorities, you know, they have the soft coercion of voluntary associations, the hard coercion of a government, have a responsibility to make sure that number is not too low, that there's not stolen property, you know, be it well-protected or not so well-protected from taxation. And I think we as individuals have a responsibility to make sure our government is doing that responsibility, because ultimately, thank God, literally, it's accountable in the end of the day to us.